theory of the Mebius, where time becomes a loop. Hello, and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast with a four-dimensional perspective on time and space. I'm Andrew Harrison, and hovering outside the limits of accepted reality with me, as usual, it's Sean Pattenden. Hi, Sean. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited this week.
I'm very excited this week because we've got two very special guests with us. Orbital Brothers, Paul and Philip Hartnell, made one of the classics of modern electronic music, Chime, on an old cassette player. To their amazement, it put them on Top of the Pops in Stop the Poll Tax t-shirts. Since then, they've perfected their own sophisticated brand of chamber rave music, becoming the de facto house band at Glastonbury. They performed with the late Stephen Hawking at the 2012 Paralympics ceremony. They split up twice because they're brothers and brothers fall out sometimes, and now they're back together again with a new album called Monsters Exist, and you just heard the first bit of the title track just then. Now they're on Big Mouth. Welcome to the show, Hartnells.
Hello. Thank you very much.
I like that introduction.
Okay, so the listeners can tell you apart. Phil, say something.
Hello, hello. This is Philip.
And Paul, say something.
Hello.
Hello. So when you meet someone at a do and they don't know what Orbital is, Phil, how do you explain them to, like, to traffic wardens and accountants and things? This is what Orbital is.
Oh, Orbital is an electronic instrumental electronic band.
Music, I think, is the word.
There you go. Yeah, we play. You probably won't have heard of us, so don't even, you know, and I don't care if I say Orbital and go, huh? Is that because people get embarrassed? You know, that's a little bit of an awkward position. They go, oh, what band are you in? And go, Orbital. And they don't let it go. I don't care. No, it's all right.
We're
underground. We're underground.
Do you ever run into Orbital fans in odd situations?
I once got accosted by an Orbital fan. It's a holiday thing, I think. I was getting sort of sat-navved into Port Isaac the wrong way, the Doc Martin village where they filmed the programme, Martin. And the sat-nav had just taken us through the twistiest, tiniest little lanes on a Saturday afternoon. It was terrifying. You know, you barely get your car in. And we just got to the seafront, massive traffic jam and everything. And then this man just leered straight in my window, elbows on the on the sort of thing, and said, "Oh, my God! You're Paul Hartnell from Orbital, aren't you?" And it was just like, oh my God, it absolutely bizarre. And I just, I am. So I'm just got to try and get my car out of this situation. Yeah. But, you know,
mind you, I must say, it doesn't really happen that often. Well, it really doesn't. No. Which is quite a good thing because you can live your life and you're not, you know, but it's a lovely, those lovely little moments because they always, when they do recognise you, they normally, generally, we've got some beautiful fans out there. And they come up with some those wonderful stories about this track that means that. And, everybody's got a wonderful story. Well, most people, you know, got a story. It's brilliant.
Well, you're back together again for the first time.
Version
3 for the first time since 2012 on the Wonky album. In a bit, we're going to talk about Monsters Exist and Your Life in Rave. Plus, because it's Big Mouth, the box sets and the telly that you love. Before that, it's nice being back in the groove, you know, good to have you together again.
Yeah, it's very great fun. Very brilliant.
Excellent. So before we get started, here's Sean with a couple of reminders.
Firstly, let joy be unbounded. We've started doing the extra bits of the show, especially for people who support us on the Patreon crowdfunding platform. If you pledge us the mere price of a pint each month via Patreon, that's £5, fancy London friends, then we'll send you a special extended 12-inch version of the show each and every week. Not in the Orbital sense of extended banging bonus beats, but in the sense of here's some extra conversation just for Patreon. You can listen via Patreon or download it and play any way you like. Paul and Phil are going to stick around too for the extra bits later.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they're looking good. So go to patreon.com and search Big Mouth to sign up without delay. Also, don't forget the special photography auction for the great music photographer Pat Pope of Melody Maker and Select fame. Pat unfortunately suffered a stroke recently and he needs help to get back on his feet. So a crack team of legendary photographers, including Rankin, Spiros Politos, Kevin Westenberg, Harry Borden, John Stoddart and many, many more have donated prints to a charity auction on catawiki.com. They are beautiful. There are rare pictures of Björk, Amy Winehouse, the Gallaghers, Elvis Costello and much more. The auctions end on Sunday the 16th of September. So search Catawiki and Pat Pope Recovery Benefit for some amazing images and a really, really good cause. So that's patreon.com, search Big Mouth, and catawiki.com, search Pat Pope Recovery Benefit.
Thank you, Sean. Right, we've got Paul and Phil Hartnell of Orbital with us, and we're going to talk about their lives in rave in a bit. But firstly, why did they get back together again? And what is this new album, Monsters Exist, all about? Here's a taster of a few tracks.
Thank you.
about the world. It's poison. And it's sick. And you want to get out of it.
A taste of the new Orbital album Monsters Exist there. That was PHUK, Please Help UK, or Acid UK, ho ho, followed by a bit of the exceedingly jolly Hoo Hoo Ha Ha, and finally an excerpt of The Raid, with what sounds to me like Tony Benn saying, you want to get out of it. Paul and Phil, is that Tony Benn?
No.
Who is it?
I'm not telling you.
Well, it's a very good Tony Benn impersonator.
Yeah, yeah, just look through your televisual kind of background of cult sci-fi viewing from the 80s, and you might find it. You might not. I might be sending you down the wrong...
Some kind of Quatermass-y end of things.
Fuck off.
Mom, fuck you.
What are you telling him for? I didn't tell him anything.
On that shit.
Well, that's kind of...
That was pretty impressive, Andrew. That's why you earned the big money.
Come on, look at your talkative massive nerd over
here. That's what I'm talking about. Well, have you heard Fuck You?
Which what?
The Fuck You, it's called. It's Please Help UK.
I always got Urgent. Yes, I always got PHUK because I'm...
Urgent, well, yeah.
So do I.
Yeah, it's PHUK, do you? Because you're... Okay,
I'm polite. But,
yeah, there you
go. Well, I'm sorry, I can't... I thought we were all friends here. So there is... The remix, actually, and so we've interjected that into the remix as well.
Oh, right.
You've not heard. You not get a copy of that.
No, we haven't got the remix.
No, that's just because we're lazy and can't be bothered to find other samples.
I've got your email now.
Excellent. So there's quite the theme going on here. Real monsters. And imagined monsters. Are we going to save the planet? Are we going to destroy it? I mean, you guys came out with a sort of punk, crass, squats culture kind of thing. Mm. It feels like all that has come back into focus now. The clock has moved right full circle, and we are back to sort of 1985.
Well, yeah. Have you seen the state of the politics?
Yeah, politics are kind of encouraging that, aren't they? They're encouraging people to behave like that, I think.
It's very similar to, I would say, the same vibe as civilization, and people know our stuff.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing, you know, and it does seem like, yeah, okay, that was, I don't know what year that was.
Civilization.
93. 93, you know, like, and now it seems like, honestly, politically, in the state of the world, or this country particularly, is... We've gone one step forward and like three steps
back.
It is the
world, actually. It's not just this country.
Yes, exactly, it is the whole world.
Really.
Yeah.
So, you know, this sort of encourages, you know, this is what is on our mind, and it comes out in the music.
Yeah.
But not always, you know, not everything. We're not all banging it, but it's just like Monsters Exist. It's more like heed a warning.
I feel like it's kind of like, you know, rather than sort of telling people what to think, it's just like it's a soundtrack to what's going on in the world. And, you know, it's to encourage you to think about it and, you know, hopefully draw your own conclusions. Who are your monsters? You know, think about them.
Yeah.
Try and do something about it.
Yeah. I remember you once told me that you made the Wonky album to have stuff that was going to really be good to play live.
Yeah.
You know, we want a tour and we want to have new stuff to play for the tour.
Yeah.
When you sat down to make this, obviously you just had your rapprochement, you got back together again. But was the way this record was going to be part of that rapprochement, part of that thing of saying, come on, we need to do this again?
For making stuff to play live, do you mean?
No, to make a record like this.
Do you know what? Each record sort of finds its own way, and that's how this one came out. It kind of presented itself with the track Monsters Exist and the title and the idea, and just kind of all fell into place like a jigsaw, you know. So getting that track was like getting the edges around the edge of your jigsaw, and the rest of it falls into place.
Right. You know? So to explain how you got back together again, because obviously brothers can split up, but they can't really split up in the sense that bands can. You're always going to be brothers. What was it that made you come back together again?
I think that for me, it was the sort of want and desire to just sort of return to have all of this sort of lovely stuff that we used to have. You know, we used to have a brother. We used to have a band that you could do these big gigs with, you know, lots of lights and visuals and all that. And that was all gone. So it's kind of like, well, that's just crazy. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It was a desire to go back to work, go back to your day job and kind of actually, you know, have that forum, that massive kind of thing. This, you know, for want of a better word, the brand of Orbital there, so you can kind of ride that wave and really enjoy it. And the only thing, you know, we hadn't spoken for about 3 years. So the only problem...
5 years.
No, we were talking for the first couple. I think it was about three that we weren't talking for.
Well, a little.
We were talking about as well as most brothers.
Yeah, I know.
Three times a week.
Go Let's not go there.
It's over. Yeah, that's it. The Mitchell brothers and techno have returned. I'll get you, Phil. But it's, you know, it was it, that's all we had to do. We had to talk. So we met just, it was just after Christmas last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had a couple of really good gigs. The Blue Dot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was what triggered it, wasn't it?
Forbidden Fruit was sort of like, well, you know, I don't know what that, whether that's triggered it, but that came on the cards, was pretty good for a band that didn't even exist. You know, so, and for me personally, it was, I just wanted to have communication with my brother again. I didn't really, you know, the orbital thing. You know, when we're not talking to each other, I'm looking back on Orbital. I go, well, what's the point? I can't enjoy these moments with, like, going on stage with Stephen Hawking and making him sing and do, you know, the whole. We've had a fantastic career, but what, to end up with Paul not talking to me, it's just like, well, what's that? I can't enjoy it all. Yeah. And him not.
No, it's not very nice.
And so, and then Forbidden Fruit and Blue Dot came up. Well, how about this about the band? And I go, well, yeah, all day long. Any chance that I got to actually, like, start my relationship back with my brother. And so this is why this is so fantastic for me, because it feels like almost like we've started again, but we haven't got all the pressures of having to, you know, like, make this work so bad, you know, we haven't got all those pressures, but we've got, like, more, like, gay abandon, which is a great word that we're using at the moment. And, yeah,
it was nearly the title of the album.
He wanted it.
Interesting.
We'd have to be different type of music, really.
That's it. No.
Anyway, I'm glad we did.
Reclaim it.
I'm glad I put. So everything, you know, okay, so I'm now communicating with brother. The gigs last year went really, really well, and the love and the response that we got from our fans was like, blew us away. And then everything now, and so then we got the album, so it's onwards and upwards, and it's really lovely and refreshing, and I don't know, I'm enjoying it so much more than we were in the past.
That's great. We've decided, though, it's like one of those sort of buddy movies. We're kind of shackled together now, sort of like a three-legged race.
See what I mean?
But we watch those films and we love them, and the guys love each other by the end of the film, don't they? Yeah. Come on, haven't you seen those kind of films?
I don't know what reference you're doing.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well,
it's not always smooth, is it, with your brothers? You do bicker and that, but I think anyone who's been in a band for 30 years on and off is bound to, aren't they?
So my question to you is, could you sit down with the Gallaghers and therapize them out of
I think so.
I did have a chat
with Noel Gallagher about it.
Yeah.
And there'd be a lot of work there to do.
Really? When you say it on Twitter, Liam is always putting out these little sort of sad little feelers, just going, posted a video of Live Forever and it'll just say, come on, our kid, XX. You want to, XX.
Yeah,
of course,
yeah.
Noel's Mardy, you know, in an understandable way. But you kind of think, he's reaching out to you here, mate. Come on, take the hand.
Maybe one day.
Yeah.
It's Noel's.
You know, if you don't, what's going to happen? You know, all of a sudden, it's like the Chuckle Brothers, isn't it? One of them died and it's like, that's it, you know?
Yeah. You didn't want to be the Chuckle Brothers of pop.
No.
Well, you know, it has been said that we're the Chuckle Brothers of techno.
There we are. That's going
Who
on.
Said that?
Me.
You just said it. So there's been
stop
a few.
Promoting.
It was to me.
There's been a few departures from the Orbital sound over the years, but this one gets right back to this is core Orbital stuff, isn't it? It's like mad complex pieces like Tiny Foldable Cities, bangers like PHUK. Did you think we need to get back to sound like, and also to look like the Orbital that people remember, because the cover as well.
The cover's like the idea of going back to that kind of Hieronymus Bosch, John Greenwood kind of look. The organic kind of, you know, analogue kind of look of that was definitely felt like the right kind of look for an album called Monsters Exist. But as far as the sort of music, I thought we were pushing the boat out. I thought we'd done something completely different. So I'm kind of pleased to know that you still hear the voice of Orbital amongst it. So that's, you know, that's a good thing.
There's departures, but it's also kind of like you definitely know who it is.
Yeah,
and it's
that's
hard.
Great.
You know, obviously I've listened to far more electronic music than is healthy. It's often difficult for people to carve out an identity, to be known for something, because there's so much reliance on presets and so much reliance on what's happening around them that sometimes you look at the stuff that came out 5 years ago and you literally can't tell who's made it. It's all just a jumble of current influences, whereas you guys all sound like yourselves, which is a useful thing.
I keep trying to copy other people and getting it wrong.
So copy yourself.
Well, I was going to ask.
Is that like having a word with yourself?
Yeah.
Do you, are you in the studio, though? Do you have musical crutches where you go, come on, we'll put the old timpani sound back on it and it sound like it? Are there some go-to sounds that you... can imprint you on it if it's starting to sound
like techniques. It's techniques. Is that playing techniques?
Sharon's asking something different, I think.
Oh, do you
she's
think
asking,
so? Let's
I
find
think
out.
She's asking that. Oh, do we go to a go-to sound that's good at that's an orbital sound? Well, we've got to make it sound like orbital. Is that what you're asking? Is that
No, I know what you're saying. Is that it's more like I sometimes think things like. You're poised, ready to say something, I know, but I kind of think, oh, I know, I could do one of those techniques, like get a sample and put it through a filter and do a certain thing. You know, there are certain... certain things. It's like, I suppose, you know, like all those sort of tools for a sort of electronic composer, I suppose, it's like having been good at finger-picking. If you're a guitarist or something, you're going, oh, I'm going to do some finger-picking because I'm good at that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just your technique.
Yeah.
And you do certainly... have them and drag them out. Certain old machines as well. You might go, let's drag out the 909 drum machine. Yes. That'll be a laugh, you know. And that's like something I've had all my life, or all my electronic life.
Yeah.
And it does happen. Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I always buy new bits of kit as well to try and force your hand into something different, you know, to find some new territory, something that you don't know what it is.
Yeah, something unexpected.
Know. And also going out there, you know, I've got into the habit of going out and spending sort of days doing field recordings of sounds and things like that, and you know, in funny places, like New Haven Fort is a big feature on this album, or the last sort of three or four jobs that I've done.
Oh, wow.
You know... projects, I should call them, not jobs. but you know, these kind of sounds that you've gathered, and they sort of become part of your sort of your voice,
your
suppose.
Repertoire.
You know, and they can be your crutches as well. You know?
So you are literally sort of near the grass, getting a bee on tape.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's a good
excellent
idea.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend once did actually try and record.
Song. Actually, I want to do a
record
bee song.
Some field.
You know, the terrible
the
thing
flight of the bumblebee.
The flight of the bumblebee.
Nice.
That's it. We got the title.
Yeah. We got the title. Yeah.
You can put
half
the
job done.
A bee sound.
Yeah.
You know.
We should. That's a good idea.
Definitely start with a good title.
The bees need help.
The bees need help,
because
of the bees need, So not many electronic bands have managed to kind of grow with their audience and sort of be able to do more complex things as their audience has got older. I saw you performing at Belfast, at the big shipyard thing, dockyard thing, and there's loads of young cheesy quavers there. You know, when you run into somebody that's like 19, what kind of things do they say about your music? Do they find it like different or surprising from the kind of straight up DJ fodder that they're perhaps used to?
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
People just come up. If they don't like you, they just don't talk to you. And if they do, they come up and say, oh, I love your music, man, or something, you know. And that's kind of where they leave it.
I normally say, where's your dad?
People do come up and say my dad likes your music, or my mum, you know.
We get lots of generation now with dads and mums are bringing their kids.
Yeah.
And indoctrination all the time. I love it.
I had a young guy come up to me... sort of fairly recently, with a pen and paper, said, I'm really sorry. Do you think you could sign this for my mum? And it's like, oh! And it was like, bless! You know, do you know what I mean?
I had the weirdest one. No, the weirdest one was this young lady. She was about 18. She said, housing. So, Mama, I was conceived on this track.
Good Lord.
No, that's a new one. That was a one.
Which track was it?
Housing.
Housing.
My mum told me I was conceived on this track. We've had weddings and funerals, you know, which is...
Well, Halcyon is a good long track, though, so that's a good song.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
Was it the extended mix?
Stamina.
Yep, there you go.
Well, that was a beautiful... I don't know. I love that. That's a beautiful thing.
That's nice. So Monsters Exist finishes with a very cosmic track, voiced by Brian Cox, talking about the eventual heat death of the universe.
Yeah.
The universe will spend an eternity in darkness after a brief period of light.
I know.
And did he do that especially for you?
Brian Eno.
Yes,
he did.
Did you meet him was that from the Blue Dots?
No, that's from Twitter. I've always wanted to sample Brian Cox. I watch his programs with the kids. I always think, oh, it's a great sample there. Oh, that would be brilliant. But there's always so much swirling ambient music in the background. You can't really sample him. And it just occurred to me, why don't you just ask him to do something? So we got in touch via Twitter, and he was totally up for it. And we sort of, you know, it was a good collaboration, because often collaborations, you know, are all done via the internet nowadays. Yeah. But we actually all did it in person, didn't we? We met up with him,
brought all
his books along, and kind of said, "What about something like this?" And was reading little sections from books and saying, "What about we get that and we put that with this?" And I've always wanted to do something about this, but it's a bit dark, so why don't I weave that in? And it was great. He was totally up for it and collaborative.
Yeah. So we had a first session in a little room like this, and he did, like as Paul said, like reading excerpts and excerpts, and you know, he had tons of material. And then it was, oh, we like this bit, you know, and he just whittled it down to 7 minutes.
Right. So you basically,
he's got a lot to say.
An audio book.
Yeah, really, in a way. Yeah, anyway. He's fantastic. We love him.
It was like a kind of way of doing your own kind of psychedelic Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I used to, well, not that wasn't psychedelic in its own way, but, you know, we used to listen to that. Like, you'd listen to concept albums as a kid. Yeah. And it's great doing it, you know, using Brian as the sort of, you know, almost like replacing the book and just doing this kind of cosmic landscape of music underneath it. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Paul and Phil's life in Rave after a bit of music. Each week we ask all of our guests to bring in a tune that they're enjoying at the moment, and Orbital aren't getting away with it just because they've got an album coming out without giving us theirs. So, Philip Hartnell, what track have you chosen?
I'm going to choose Just by Bicep.
Okay, why are you choosing that?
Oh, I love those guys. I love them. Yeah, you know, I got hooked into them a while ago. It's my go-to thing. Just love I just love what they produce.
Let's have a listen. Yeah. This is Just by Bicep.
Yeah.
That was Just by Bicep, as chosen by Phil Hartnell of Orbital there. Many, many years ago, and especially taxing at Glastonbury, I force-marched a group of people, including Sian, to see you two on the NME stage. It was 1994, and it was the first performance of Are We Here, with that terrifying What Does God Think voice peeling out amongst the very kind of mentally weak and vulnerable hall. Do you remember that, Sian? Do you remember that?
Can I tell you the absolute truth? Is I remember it a bit, but I don't remember it specifically, if you know what I mean. But I remember going, my mouth is open.
Yes.
Really? Yes. And it did start. We played Orbital in the select office. You played them in the select office every day. And it did start this mild obsession. And Insides, I think, is one of my favourite albums of the 90s.
No,
I do.
Brilliant.
I really, really do.
Fantastic.
And one of the litmus tests of anybody is, what other kind of music do you like? And if they say Insides by Orbital, then they pass. I've even had this conversation with Sarah Nixie from Black Box Recorder, who looks like the least Orbital person you ever meet. Yes, so. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant.
Yes,
nice.
And
oh,
always ran to the
story.
Front.
Lovely
yeah.
story.
Yeah.
Lovely,
playing.
I'm loving it.
So you were one of the first electronic bands to become an actual full-on live draw, you know, going sort of from Megadog to Glastonbury and beyond. Did it kind of alarm you to be in front of these thousands of people when you're used to being doing it in a bedroom in a small place? As the audience has got bigger and bigger, did it start to freak you out a bit?
I think that Glastonbury 94 was definitely a massive jump up. Mm. But I mean, I don't think anyone, but I don't, you know, your first Glastonbury, no one's prepared for that unless you used to do stadiums or something. You know, it's absolutely shocking. And exciting and brilliant at the same time. It was like being in the Lord of the Rings film, you know, looking at the audience. It was just like, Peter Jackson Ork Army. It was brilliant.
But the
sort of, there was no kind of build up to that. It does get bigger and bigger. You know, we went from clubs and, you know, not being looked at that much to sort of playing on stages with the Megadog, the Megadog and the Megadog MIDI Circus tour. And then we did a tour in America and things like that. So you kind of build up to it. But I think your first Glastonbury is a pretty big milestone,
Phil, I was going to say, for me, it's like you've got the audience in front of you, and they could be like three people, 30,000, 80,000, whatever you like. It was a fantastic moment. We go, whoa, like that. But if they're enjoying it, that is the most important thing. You know, like I say, even if it's three people, which we have played to for three people, and they're jumping around, it's like, I'm locked in.
Certainly.
You know what I mean? And that is just like, you know, like exaggerate it with more and more people. And if they're digging it and they're going for it, you know, that's what I ask for. The people there that are listening, that are digging it, and I can feel that, whether however many people there are.
And about probably about 15 years later, you managed to get Matt Smith, the then Doctor Who, to appear on stage for the Doctor Who theme with his orbital glasses on.
What a coup.
How'd you pull that one off?
Brilliant.
Then?
Well, do you remember when the Icelandic ash cloud happened and everyone got stranded in different countries?
Oh, yeah.
We were in America. We were at just done Coachella Festival, and we were stuck in America. They said, well, you're not going to be able to leave. And we were there for like at least a week and a half.
Extra. I ran off and got married.
Yeah, that's how long we were there.
No, I'm not
that's
joking. I eloped on the Wednesday.
It doesn't take him long.
I eloped on the Wednesday. No need for that, Paul. And, I eloped on the Wednesday, ended up going to Vegas, got married in a helicopter.
Well, there you go.
I know, she's waiting for me around the corner. So, you know, miracles do happen. Yeah. The best thing ever.
Thanks for that volcano.
No, it was. Yeah. It was because of that, wasn't it? And then we were at an after show party.
I went. You did turn up eventually.
I did, yeah. But you'd left
those crazy, but yeah, crazy all night.
No,
parties.
No, you hadn't left. I did meet you there because you dropped a beer on your new blue suede shoes.
Yeah, when someone's booed.
Well, a lot happened at that party. A lot happened at that party.
Help, help! Like that. And I went, what? Ah! To grab their beer and it dropped. And
wonderful shoes.
Crazy party. But we were talking about Doctor Who.
Yeah, Matt Smith. Where's he come into this?
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, there I was at this party. You know, it was early sort of time, quite respectable. And I was just going to the fridge for a beer. And I was following this nice tall man. And he opened the fridge door. And this light kind of radiated out of him. And I thought, God, that's Doctor Who. It was one of those moments. I said to him, excuse me, are you Doctor Who? And he turned around and looked at me with his best kind of David Niven accent and said, oh, yes, well, actually, I am. Mm, you know, and it was just, oh, brilliant. And we just got talking. And I said, he said, well, what do you do? Who are you? And I told him. And he said, oh, my God, you're the guys that do the theme tune. And that was it. And I was standing there with our lighting guy, Johnny. And he said, oh, I'd love to come on and introduce you one time. And Johnny said, what about Glastonbury? And we just all went, oh, my God, that's a great idea. We swapped numbers and then made it happen.
Yeah, he'd never been to Glastonbury before, Matt Smith.
Oh, my goodness.
Obviously, wandering around, Paul went round with him, wandering around Glastonbury. So we agreed, yeah, OK, we did it. I mean, because it's the BBC, he can't be Doctor Who. Mm. He can't portray Doctor Who because then you're commercially...
Copyright,
Yeah, you're commercially, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, you know...
But he did wear his trench coat, didn't he? No, which he then ensconced into the next series.
So then we had this idea. Yeah, so then he's wandering around and everybody's like, you know, like off their nut or whatever.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And you've seen Matt Smith wandering around. Oh, my God, it's Doctor Who.
But he's also seeing it with new eyes. That must have
been
incredible to be with someone.
So we made sure that he was, you know, got all the bits and bobs that he needed, you know, the cars and everything.
Yeah.
You know, and he absolutely had a ball. Because also, he's not performing, he's an actor, but he's only performing to a camera.
Mm.
You know, and, you know, he's not got, you know, unless you're doing theatre and stuff like that, which he wasn't at the time.
But he hadn't done a theatre for sort of a long time.
They absolutely love the live audience. And so, you know, then we pretended that the screen's broken. And then we got Johnny, the same guy that could, you know, had the idea. He sort of got the laser guys that he knew that we paid them. And, oh, well, get some lasers. And it looked like he's beamed in there. And, I need help, you know, get some glasses, Bob. He loved it, and so did I. It was fantastic. It worked out really well.
Great fun.
Well, the last Glastonbury, I was watching Radiohead, and there's a big tall bloke in front of me that I wanted to sort of see if I could move to the left.
No way.
Matt Smith,
no
Doctor
way.
Who.
Brilliant.
And I took, have a beer, mate. Have it. No, it's absolutely fine. I've got some. Thank you very much.
So he's gone again then since.
Yeah, he has gone again. Definitely.
Brilliant.
He had a hat pulled down very, very tightly.
Yeah.
So tell us about the Stephen Hawking thing as well, because you did Stephen Hawking.
Oh, my word.
Worked with Stephen Hawking at the Paralympics. Was it the opening or the closing? I can't remember.
The opening.
It was the opening ceremony.
That was fantastic.
Where you did one of your tracks going into Ian Dury's Spasticus Autistic.
Yeah, that was their idea.
It was an absolutely crazy idea. You know, when someone throws you a curve, They start with an idea and say, can you do some music that scores something that looks like a Large Hadron Collider? Oh, and it'll have an introduction with Stephen Hawking. You go, great, I'm in. Brilliant.
So here we got
and
his,
then
we
they
got
say his... to you, oh, actually, yeah, well, you are going to do that, but then you've got to go into a live rendition of Ian Dury, and then it's going to come out of that back into you again. And you're like, oh, Christ, how's this going to work? And then it was lucky that we came up with the idea of just grabbing the track, where is it going? And I kind of tried it out. I realised I had a bit that I just thought, I bet we can fit that into Ian Dury. And it fitted like a glove. And then it was like, right, well, what else can we do? Let's make Stephen Hawking sing.
Yeah.
Why not? Because we had his speech and we did this kind of bed, you know, intro, and then just got his voice and did a, you know, full on sort of pitch correction and singing voice and got him singing along with us.
Yeah, again, auto-tune. It's the
auto-tune. Don't try and spin it. It wasn't a vocoder. It was auto-tune.
All right.
Andrew, you're so near. No flies on him.
Yeah. But it was absolutely wonderful. So we went for rehearsals and da-da-da-da-da, and he was coming the next day. So we're chatting to the girl that's like, he's an artist liaison sort of girl. Yeah. We're telling him, oh, it'd be fantastic if you wore the torch glasses. So she's had a word with him, and she's going down. She was brilliant. So she's going, and he's so up for it.
He was totally up for it.
And he wore the torch glasses.
Yeah.
And for him to wear those, he had to take his real glasses off, which he can't see anything really, because you know, and he's so up for it. And then, you know, and we met him afterwards, gave him a CD and all that, and I sent him actually a condensed, like without the spasticus elastic, yeah. in, you know, sent him that, and he sent me back an email going, he'd listened to her LP, loved her LP. He's going, when are we going to release this single? He was like so up for it, like he was brilliant.
Fantastic.
It was fucking lovely.
You can swear. It's okay.
You can swear. It's a podcast. You can say what you like. So basically, let's be honest. This entire Orbital project is just so you can go and be like fanboys to scientists, isn't it?
He was. I don't go wobbly at many people, but the Stephen Hawking was one of them, I must say.
Yeah. Now, I've got a question about, because you're known for a lively and raucous and ridiculously insane live show. What are you actually doing up there? Because it's not playing in the conventional sense, is it? What are the hands doing?
It's kind of... I always modelled sort of the live show on what I thought... This is the interesting thing, what I thought Tangerine Dream were doing.
Right.
I've no idea whether it is or not. I've just got this mental idea of what I think they...
So what did they do? Rewind,
because it started... When we do... OK, we've got to take our machine out live. We just set a studio up on stage.
Yeah.
Which is what I just said. That's what I thought Tangerine Dream were doing.
Calm down.
Because...
Well, they play instruments.
No, they don't. So a little bit, but they used to... Well, that's the thing. They do play a little bit of instruments, but they were doing a lot of sequencing and things like that, and kind of tweaking big old modular synths while their sequences were playing.
And that's kind of... I liked that idea.
And I knew that they used to jam and things like that. And it's like, yeah, well, this... You know, when we started off, tracks were made by basically jamming. You'd have, like, four synths, two drum machines, a four-track. You get something going until everything's used.
Yeah.
And then you go, right, everything's done. You've got a little 8-track sequencer and drum machines, things. You go, right, let's record it. And the recording process was basically to have a jam with this stuff and do, you know, get into a groove with it and make a, you know, what was, I suppose, a dance track or a piece of house music or industrial sort of rhythm or whatever you were doing. And that's how you used to arrange, just on the fly. That's how a lot of people did it. And so to go kind of live just felt like, well, you just do the same. You just go up there with all your bits prepared and you just start jamming it out, which is what we still do.
What we're actually doing, if you can imagine, like, we've got two iPads now. It used to be sequencers where you go bass, drum, hi-hat on each little button, bass, drum, hi-hat, you know, all the bits and bobs for that track.
Yeah.
You know, so you go, well, the bass drum doesn't come in until you press that button. You know, so you can make and so there's no pre-arranged arrangement. There's no, like, song mode or anything like that that we go in. So you press the button and it'll send out a MIDI message to the drum machine that you've got there, and then that drum machine will send the sound into your mixing desk that you've got there. Then you've got all the levels and the EQs and the effects that you can add to it on your mixing desk. So if you've got a sequence on the synthesizer that's there, you've got the manipulation and modulation, as Sean says, you know, and so you've got all that all going into your mixing desk, and then and a song can last a minute or an hour.
Essentially, if you're, much as a live band would do, which a live band playing instruments would do, you can go, this needs a bit of a kick up the arse here, we can move that around.
Exactly, more of an improv, more of an old 70s improvisation sort of thing, but improvisation with the structure of the song.
So it's basically...
And the manipulation, through the nation.
It's basically a gigantic drum solo played on absolutely everything, all at the same time.
Yeah, but with tunes.
Drum solo with tunes.
Oh, yeah.
One last question before we move on to some other stuff. I mean, the classic sort of old stages of rave, Aphex, The Prodigy, The Chemical Brothers, you guys, you've now been around and active and creative and changing and developing your stuff for like 30 years.
I know.
That is as long a span as it goes from Bill Haley to Acid House.
crazy.
Fantastic.
It's mad. It's like 50% of the history of popular music. So, yeah. So, I mean, do you ever look at it and go, bloody hell, I have no idea it was going to be like this. That it could go on for so
completely,
long.
Completely.
Do you don't know it's going to be like this. Go on, carry on.
No, okay, completely. Like you say, you know, other sort of rock and the other trends or, you know, in musical eras, you know, like, so they don't really last that long.
Yeah.
But this is where we're, you know, I think electronic music is very, very different in that sense, because it's not about the identity of the pop star or anything like that. It's about the music pretty much on its own. And so, you know, we're getting away with it like that. Yeah. You know, getting away with it in that way.
I think people listen to music in a different way, though, now as well.
Yeah,
I think it's beneficial for everyone. When I was sort of young and in the 80s, people used to go, oh, go away, Grandad, on people's third albums.
Yeah. Maybe they're saying that now, we don't know.
Maybe, but I don't know if they are, because the entire sort of history of recorded music is in your iPhone now. And so it's kind of a level playing field. You know, you've got to remember, back in the 80s, if you missed buying a single when it was out, that's it, it was gone.
Yeah.
You couldn't get it. You know, that you'd have to trade it with a mate or something. Mm-hmm. And music was very much, you know, going down a sort of timeline, and it would always be about what was current.
Yeah.
Whereas now it really isn't. You can everything's available, and that's kind of made, I don't know, it's taken sort of the whole ageist thing out of it in a weird kind of way, because everybody seems sort of relevant all at the same time. It's weird. It's like an omnipresence
ecstasy.
Of culture.
I blame ecstasy.
String theory. Yeah.
String theory.
Yeah, string theory.
It's now
ecstasy.
String theory in music.
Yeah. Well, as we're talking about the developments and amazingness of the history of electronic music, I asked the Hartnells to bring in a classic tune, an electronic tune from the past, just for so they could choose one. What have we got here?
Yeah, well, I chose Autobahn by Kraftwerk. This was about 10. My elder brother, which we don't talk about much, but Dr. Gary Hartnell, chief consultant at the premature baby care unit at Chiltern Smith Hospital. I must put in there. Hello, Gary. And I saw Autobahn. It was like, oh my God, it really did move me, because one, it was like electronic. The other thing, it was like more, it was a concept album.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what blew me away. It was like, where are these sounds? And that's what, it's like, what I needed to know, what made these sounds. You know, electricity, you know, it's sort of like, you know, so that and the concept, and it's about a motorway. And it's like, well, guys, you know, and they get away with it.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And it's genius, you know, and that was very influential on me at that time. And, you know, it's got a very special place in my heart.
Definitely. And Paul, what have you got?
The Severed Heads, one of my biggest, most influential electronic bands of all time for me. I remember sort of hearing that the album that comes off of Since the Accident, and it absolutely kind of blew me away, the whole concept of people being able to make electronic music that's simultaneously dirty, scary, sort of... yet very scary, but at the same time sort of hauntingly beautiful at the same, you know.
Yeah,
it was unbelievable. I hadn't really heard that before. Electronic music was quite often pop and shiny at the time, and then Dead Eyes Opened came on, which is the highlight of the album for me. I mean, it was there, I think they had a sort of a hit with it in Australia back in the day, but you know, it was kind of like sort of dirty Kraftwerk or something like that. And that was a whole concept that I'd never really kind of felt. And it's so harmonically rich. It's something that I still always try and get into my music. Even now, I still think in terms of Severed Heads. You know, massive, massive influence.
Well, here we go. Here's Clean Kraftwerk followed by Dirty Kraftwerk. It's also bombed by Kraftwerk and Dead Eyes Opened by Severed Heads.
Was Phil's electronic classic Autobahn by Kraftwerk, obviously. followed by Dead Eyes Open by Severed Heads, as chosen by Paul. You can get them on that Trevor Jackson Presents Metal Dance Industrial Post-Punk ERM Classics and Rarities 80 to 88. Now, because it's Big Mouth and it's not just music, it's telly and film as well, we're asking the Orbital Brothers for their TV box set addictions, the ones they're battering at home or on the tablet whilst touring the world. There are two choices each. Paul Hartnell, your two choices, I believe, are Game of Thrones and The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's many other programmes as well, but I'm so gagging for the next series of Game of Thrones. You know, I loved it. I watched it from day one. Unassuming program. I just thought, oh, I'll watch that. And I, after the first episode, I just thought, that's hilarious. That's sort of like sort of sword and sandals Star Trek. It's, yeah. it really doesn't take itself that seriously, and it's ridiculous. And yeah, totally drawn in. And you know, even when I think series two finished, I couldn't wait any longer. So I actually went to the books and just read all the books as well, waiting for for the next series to start.
What do you have a favourite character arc from the last two series? Who's going through what?
Oh, that's interesting, because, you know, I mean, Tyrion's always been a favourite. I mean, you know, surely he's everyone's favourite. I don't know. But I kind of like what's happening to Jaime Lannister.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm having empathy for him. And he was, you know, when I think about him in episode one, he's a horrible man, you know. But I've got empathy for Jaime Lannister.
That's one of the key things that happens in it, though, isn't it? That you are, it plays with what you think are the established things about sword and sorcery and fantasy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
People are always going to retain their characteristics. And yet, even, you know, people like the Hound have changed.
I love him. He's one of my favourites. The Hound and the little girl. What's she called?
Arya.
And also,
they're a couple of my favourites.
Arya is changing as well from this kind of innocent heroine into really dangerous individual.
Dangerous, yeah, she is.
Right. and this is the point where I go, I still haven't watched it. I refuse to watch. Well, yeah, everyone's watched it. I thought, I can't do it now. Can I? How can I keep up? No, it's two series.
That's a treat for you.
That's a lot of my life.
Yeah, well, like pizza in the bed. What's the matter with that on Sunday?
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. So, yeah, binge it, girl.
Mm. I don't know if I like dragons, and there are a lot of ladies in the nude. Discuss. Is it like that? Tell me
that's such a small part of it.
But there are dragons.
There's a lot of naked ladies sort of gratuitously in the first two series. You do think, oh my god, really?
It was a brothel.
It was
though,
so But there's all this kind of stuff going on, and then someone would go, anyway, and you think, well, hang on, what was that all about? And it's just like a total, you know, but the whole programme is very indulgent like that, you know.
But were there enough men in the buff?
There's quite a lot of men.
They do try and address that a little bit.
Do you see the offending item, the Willies?
Willie in Game of Thrones? I'm sure there is.
I mean, they don't really do it, do they? They don't really do it the same as, like,
no,
it's not the same response, is it, really?
But... yeah, but the I think the nudity is definitely dialed down as the series has gone on.
Right,
dragons. They're always in the nude.
You can't get them in clothes anymore.
You can't get dragon clothes anymore.
Not the sizes.
Bloody Amazon.
You used to be able to, like those little Scotty dog kind of coats.
What's that? Since Brexit.
What I liked about the dragons and the magic aspect of Game of Thrones.
Go on, try and persuade.
For the entire first series, there isn't any of it. For the entire first series, you don't even understand that this world is a world where magic works. It's a violent political drama.
Right. Oh.
And then something happens at the end of the first series that expands the universe usually, and you go, oh, hang on a minute, there's actual magic in this world.
Mm.
And the dragons are off screen for a hell of a long time.
Yeah, they don't even appear.
They're sort of metaphors for nuclear weaponry. A lot of people have said this, that they are the ultimate weapon. And if you see them bit by bit by bit. Actually, you see them grow from little baby dragons, like on either the engine, to a full-size thing that can toast the city with its halitosis. And that's also quite compelling, because it's not just like, oh, bloody hell, a dragon. You're sort of made to think about what a world would be like where things like this existed.
Right. Yeah, but actually, they're not gratuitous, really.
Actually,
for me,
I got completely confused about who's who and who's that and what tribe do they belong to. Like, I couldn't cope with all that, but I just went with it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes so happy. It's a bit of a reflection on how pathetic people are. And how we, you know, a reflection on the world, really, to be honest.
Yeah.
And they're all fighting amongst each other, trying to trying to win this and all that. It's like, actually, guys, we've got the fucking White Walkers coming here, and nobody knows about this, and they're just going to completely annihilate you, you know, because if a White Walker kills you, then they right. raise from the dead and they join the White Walkers. It's like, fucking, we could call that global warming, whatever you like. You know, but it is actually quite reflective on how pathetic the human race are.
But don't zombie hordes normally represent the mass of humanity?
Yeah. Well, the zombie horde is approaching. You know, we watch zombie movies now, and we used to watch space invasion movies in the 50s, because in the 50s we were frightened that the communists are going to come and get us.
Yeah.
And now we're frightened of enormous catastrophes we cannot master.
Yeah. Just big global waves. Warming. Global warming, maybe.
Somebody should make an electronic album about that.
You know, let's say, hello, maybe.
Game of Thrones global cooling.
There you go.
We've made a start with Brian Cox.
There you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Then what do you think with the seventh and final series? What's going to happen there?
I think it's going to be kind of the sort of tying up kind of, right, sort of series. I think we've had most of the fun. Okay. I think a lot of these big stuff, it's got to tie it up at the end. Do you know what I mean? We've got the finally, the love interest has happened. Finally, the White Walkers are coming. Finally, the humans have all got to
get their act together.
Band together, and defeat the White Walkers and all go arm in arm, go, oh God, it wasn't that good. They're and just like having to deal with kind of the last guy in the Lord of the Rings, you know, there'll be Cersei to deal with at some point, but you know, that's kind of
I'm a fan as well of Game of Thrones. I'll tell you what I want to happen is that White Walker come out and completely annihilate everybody, because that is what that is what I was saying about the similarity between the real world and that world.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen, man. You're too late. You're too late to band together. That's the message.
You're not looking for a cheery field. Yeah,
no, I'm not. I mean, you know.
That's kind of what Brian says as well, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The death of the universe.
In the long run, we're all dead.
Oh, dear, please. Mm. Let's have one of Phil's choices. Right, you've chosen... Similarly, Lost in Space.
Lost in Space. Hello.
This is what like when I. Or the old one?
Oh, no. No, wait a minute. I just say rewind. I've got that blew my mind when I was a little kid. Mm-hmm. When I was a little kid, I just loved, identified. I was the same age as Will Robinson. It was like about 10, you know, it was like Monday evening before I went to swimming lessons. Lost in Space, I loved it. I felt all lonely and had a little, and he had a little Robbie the Robot as a friend. I just wanted a bit. I was so jealous of him, but I loved it, you know. And then recently, Lost in Space, a remake. I go, wait a minute, you're messing with my mind. You know, this has got to be good. This has to be good for something that is my very first favourite programme ever, and fantasy. And mate, they didn't disappoint. It blew my mind. It was really good. It was. They did it in such a way that it's moved on. They've got some other lots of characters, a lot more sort of women involved now, and a lot more, you know, they've brought it really up to date. And Robbie the Robot, it blows my mind. He is just like, he's the best sort of robot that I've ever seen, really, in a movie, you know, in a series. And it the storyline and everything, I mean, they're just setting up the whole storyline now, anyway. And they do hark back to, what's he called, Dr. Smith and all that. Dr. Smith is now a woman, which is good, you know, that's what I mean. They're introducing a lot more women characters where they used to be men.
Yes.
So Dr. Smith is a woman, and it's brilliant, because if you watch the original series, you know. You know, like with Dr. Smith, he's got his own things going, and she's got her own things going. Do you know what I mean? It's brilliant. And Robbie the Robot is brilliant. It's Robbie, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they haven't called him Robbie the Robot in
no, this. But he is. He's fantastic.
He's basically not by any other name.
He is. And the way they've done it, and who designed him, the design of the robot is fantastic. And he's a lost little robot from some other planet that he's, you know, he's a bit of a dropout.
Oh, they've given him a much more mysterious background than
I know,
the original.
It's wonderful.
You've kind of sold me on that now.
It's really wonderful.
Does it feel like it's the child you watching it now? Or is it the grown-up you watching it?
Ooh, well, I still identify.
Yeah.
Is there a difference?
I still haven't got any friends. I still feel lonely. I still feel
and
an outsider.
And does it resonate? Do you think that those themes that they're...
Yeah, they do. They do. But they do. It's really up to date. It's really up to date. So it's sort of... they twisted the stories around and everything like that. But, you know, I like the characters, like I say, and, you know, they've introduced a lot more. You know, it's a very modern script, do you know what I mean? And it really is.
But they've kind of ended up, haven't they? The very last sort of episode, the end of that, they've ended up where kind of episode two of the original series would have been, where they've literally been thrown out into space and they don't know where they are with the original set of characters that were originally on the ship, whereas the whole first series was kind of building up to where the original series, you know,
the original series.
So it's really great. It's really exciting because you think the next series, wow, we're going to be properly lost in space.
Because the original series just starts with them lost in space, don't it? Lost in on this planet, didn't it?
Yeah, I think they get lost on the first episode. They just do that thing on TV programs. They get lost in the first 10 minutes, then that's it.
Yes. Did you see the Matt LeBlanc version, the film?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And. Fair enough. Paul, your other choice is The Handmaid's Tale.
Ooh.
Not harrowing at all, mate. What do you love about it?
Well, I love Margaret Atwood. I loved the original book, and I just thought, surely, if they, you know, they made a film of it before, and it was a sort of half-assed version. And this TV series was just brilliant because they kind of brought it up to date as well. And you know, the thing is, when you make a TV series of a book, you can expand on the book rather than trying to squash it into an hour and a half of a film, which is where they always fail. And they did it so beautifully. They really, you know, threw in a lot of modern flourishes and some extra storylines, which, you know, like the sort of the husband in Canada and that kind of thing was very interesting. But it's so powerful. It makes me, you know, I found myself getting really angry every time I'm watching it. It's just like the horror of what's, you know, because a lot of these things go on in this world under the name of religion already.
Mm.
And you just think, oh, my God, it's awful that people can do, you know, can do this kind of thing.
So do you think we all watch it and we are identifying with the Elizabeth Moss character and then her sort of colleagues, if that's what you could call them, the handmaids. We're going with her, aren't we, rather than anyone else?
Yeah, oh, God, yeah,
you
course.
Really just get sucked into that, whether you're a man, woman, or anything else.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah, it's just the whole thing of, you know, how awful would it be to be, you know, you kind of feel entrapped by society, or you can do, but then this is going deeper, and one, you know, this is being an actual prisoner,
hostage.
You know, she is a prisoner. She's been taken
prisoner.
She's a slave,
isn't she?
You completely see it happening because they've got closed estates, you know, with, you know, shielded estates, you know, like they have. So why not have a shielded area, you know, with, you know, you're not allowed in, not allowed out, at least, you know. And you can see that the fact is that, you know, what is it, that fertility is gone. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And so, like, all the chosen few that have got enough money and power holding these, you know, people as prisoners, as baby machines, you know. And you could see that happening. I mean, it's, you know, artificial insemination, you know, it's all there already.
Did the second series take it too far, though, do you think? Because, I mean, the first one, I couldn't even watch to the end. I actually found it too upsetting and didn't know if I could just go into
it. It's upsetting.
It really upset me. So I didn't know if I could put myself back there.
I don't think the second series is as good as the first one, because the first one is a classic bit of Margaret Atwood. The second series, best will in the world.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's good fun to see what fun. That's the wrong word.
Yeah.
It's harrowing to see where they can go with it or what they can do. But it doesn't have the flair of Margaret Atwood. No way.
I stopped watching it. It felt like they were dragging out a second series for the financial gain. To me, it didn't seem to
I don't
really,
know. I think they tried, but I don't think
really
it's
for me.
It's not as good. But I watched I did watch it through to the end. It did nearly lost me a couple of times, but I kept going. And I did enjoy it, and I will watch, you know, the third series
I think I might go for a bit of second series when I'm feeling in a very, very strong and stable mood.
Yeah.
So Phil, you've chosen Star Trek Discovery as well, but you both watch it.
Yes,
tell us about
The Discovery, especially with the disco, the disco tops running around in their, you know, when they're in sort of with their gym outfits, it says disco. I just think that that, you know, I lost it a little bit, and then Jean-Luc Picard sort of picked up Star Trek with the storylines and everything like that. Yeah. Now, this to me, I'll come on in, you know, let's see, all right, let's watch it. And it was just the characters and the storylines. It just grabbed me, and it was really well written, I think.
Tell us about this badge that you've got that links to your phone. What is it,
The Star Trek, it's a proper badge. It's a Bluetooth badge, and you hook it up, obviously, with your phone. And when your phone goes, it goes, you know, that thing, and you hit it, you know, hello, and you talk into it. You can play music out of it and everything. It's brilliant.
It's basically an operating working Starfleet.
I know, this is the thing. This is the thing.
Discovery, I found it hard to get on with initially because I thought this didn't feel like the Star Trek that Gene Roddenberry's idea was. Because his idea was like a perfect future where, you know, all races and all the rest of it are all getting on together in a kind of fantasy of discovery and kind of United Federation of Planets, you know, future EU kind of thing. And the one in Discovery, it's so grim. It's a war story. And I found that hard to get into. But actually, the further into the series I got, the more I enjoyed it because the characters are actually pretty good.
Yeah, you have to live with it a bit. I mean, I'm not even sure about Michael. You know, she was, you know, one of the, you know, the,
she's the key
my
character.
Favourite is the captain. I can't remember.
Captain Lorca.
Oh, he is fantastic.
And we get a dark captain in Star Trek. They're always so worthy, aren't they? To have like a moody, dark captain.
And he's literally a dark captain because his eyes have been damaged and he can't have the lights on.
I know, he's brilliant.
Jason Isaacs.
He's fantastic. Yeah, it just really floated my boat again. Rekindled my enthusiasm for Star Trek. It really did, because I'd lost it a bit, to be honest, you know, and it was way back it was a kid thing, you know, and I enjoyed it through there, and then, you know, picked it up, like I say, Jean-Luc Picard was good, stories elevated, now this Discovery, it's great, for me, it's gone, whoa, wait a minute, when's the next one coming out?
Well, you must be very excited that Jean-Luc Picard is coming back, and they're doing the next generation.
Oh, I saw that.
They are
really?
Starting again.
You don't know that. Oh, I know. Yeah.
What's that going to be? What do you know? Tell us, Andrew. What do you know about it?
All I know is that they've said they're going to do it. And I quite like that with most, I think, of the original cast of The Next Generation. Brilliant. And I quite like the idea of, like, a starship full of old fellas and old
Expendables. Funny, that. Expendables in space.
Funny, like, that. Yeah, old people in space.
Well, look, because they're doing it set...
Of the summer space wine.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing it...
that is brilliant.
They're doing it 20 years later, aren't they?
Yeah.
But, okay, and that's fine, because everyone's aged. What are they going to do about Data?
Maybe he has been artificially aged to make him feel more palatable to humans.
Brilliant. You've just said exactly what I say they're going to do, so I think it's in the script.
There's no need for robots to be shaped like humans. They're only there to make us feel comfortable. So a robot should grow old.
He's artificially aged himself.
Oh, he's thought about it.
You could do a great thing. Well, actually, in real-life navies, experience... is valued, isn't it? You become an admiral. You go upstairs, you do planning.
We're using that for Orville.
There you go. Also in Acid House experience. Yeah, exactly. You get kicked upstairs, straight to the House of Lords. So it could be a similar kind of thing. The House of Lords in space. How about that?
House of Lords.
You'd need a bit of a better title than that.
I would totally watch that. So you are quite the sci-fi twosome, as we've heard. I have to ask, what's your take on the female Doctor Who?
Brilliant.
Bring it on.
It's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, let's have a look. See how it goes. Depends on how she's acting in the script, really, doesn't it? Obviously, really.
I think she's pretty dependable on the acting.
I think. I think she'll pull it off. I think
so. So is Peter Capaldi, but I didn't like Peter Capaldi's Doctor Who, as it were, but I don't think the script supported him properly. I like him as an actor, you know, so. Yeah. But I think they're going to pull it out of the bag with this one.
Yeah, well, it's basically a total reboot, isn't it? It's almost giving like a new show, and I think that's what they should always do.
Yeah, I think
they should start it again from scratch.
Definitely.
Right on. Finally, it's time for Paul Hartnell's choice of current tune. What have you got, Paul?
Lisa Hannigan, Prayer for the Dying.
And why is that? You can't just get away with that.
I love her album. I love this album. It's one of my go-tos. I've got it on vinyl. I don't listen to it anywhere else apart from on vinyl. Mm-hmm. And I put it on, and this track two just... It's so relaxing and melancholy and beautiful and sort of sad and achingly. It's weird because it's sort of it sounds modern to me in its kind of voice and its approach, but really it sounds like an old kind of thing. You'd almost imagine Connie Francis doing it from the 50s. It's a little bit David Lynch in its in its soundscape. But it's not old. It's modern as well. It's beautiful.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
Well, let's have a listen. This is Prayer for the Dying by Lisa Hannigan.
That was Lisa Hannigan and Prayer for the Dying. Now, I have got a question for you about Monsters Exist. I have a theory about the first track, and okay. I want to ask, and you don't have to tell the truth. But to me...
nice, I like these kind of questions.
Yeah, you might want to make it obscure, but to me, I've listened to it quite a few times. Is it a news theme? It reminds me of Channel 4 News. Boom, boom. Is it...
Oh, my...
That is what it is.
Goodness!
Can I ask?
Do you know what I say if anyone says to me... And all the interviews I've been doing recently, and anyone says, Monsters Exist, tell me about that. And I say, it's like a psychedelic, fictitious theme tune to a current affairs programme.
Yes! Oh, excellent.
Yes, and you've nailed it. That's
fantastic.
Exactly
so
what
pleased.
It is.
Achievement.
A gold star, definitely.
That is a gold star. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
It would be great if the BBC were to replace their...
That's what I thought. Yeah, with Monsters, News. Yeah.
Their bit, which I've liked. You know, their kind of Pet Shop Boys, which they've been running for 20 years now. Bin it off, give it to Orbital. Let's face it.
Right. Buy that for a dollar.
There you go. And that brings us to the end of this week's Big Mouth, or at least to the end of the main bit, because Paul and Phil are going to stick around for the extra bit for Patreon subscribers in a minute. In the meantime, thanks to the both of them for coming on the show. What's happening next? The album's coming out literally tomorrow. What are you going to be doing to bring it to the world?
Well, gigs and more gigs, isn't it?
Yeah, we've got like Christmas
DJing tonight. We're playing live tomorrow. We're playing live again tomorrow. And we're doing two different gigs tomorrow. Then we've got a Christmas sort of tour, haven't we, around the UK?
Yeah,
we're going
that's become traditional. That's
what we like. I like that. And then we've got ADE. We're playing at ADE Paradiso. We've got a little Scandinavian. Well, I say
we've got a little Euro tour.
We've got a little Euro tour going on. So Amsterdam is going to be next thing in October with the ADE, which I'm really looking forward to that. That's one of my favourite venues.
Doing three gigs in America as well. Yeah. And then next year we're sloping off to New Zealand for the first time and Australia.
We've been to Australia before, but never
New Zealand, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Fantastic.
Very busy.
Sounds brilliant. And Monsters Exist is out. Well, by the time you hear this, listeners, it'll be out. So thanks to the Orbital chaps.
Thanks to
our amazing producer, Sophie Black. Don't forget, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show and get those extra bits coming up in a minute, you can buy us that virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. We'll see you all next week. Patreon backers, stick around. But in the meantime, I'm going to play you out with what else? Orbital with Chime. See you next week.
Great.